From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Quite honestly, when corporate CEOs see that those firms are representing the very terrorists who hit their bottom line back in 2001, those CEOs are going to make those law firms choose between representing terrorists or representing reputable firms.
A top Pentagon official calls on corporations to boycott law firms with attorneys representing prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Then jury selection begins in the trial of Lewis Scooter Libby. His former boss, Vice President Dick Cheney, is expected to be called as a witness. Investigative reporter Murray Wass leaks more information from inside the grand jury room. But first, we look at domestic spying and more on how the Pentagon and CIA have been secretly obtaining the private financial records of thousands of Americans. We'll speak with former Guantanamo chaplain Yi. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 150 people were killed across Iraq Tuesday in one of the worst days of violence in weeks. At least 70 people were killed in an attack outside Baghdad University. Most of the victims were female students. Four U.S. troops were also killed in Mosul. The violence came as the United Nations said more than 34,000 civilians died in Iraq last year. This is Gianni Magazzini, the chief UN human rights official in Iraq.
The civilian population remains the main victim of the prevailing security situation. Law enforcement agencies do not provide effective protection to the population of Iraq, and increasingly militias and criminal gangs act in collusion with or have infiltrated the security forces.
Meanwhile, President Bush continued to promote his plan to send another 21,000 troops to Iraq. In an interview with PBS, Bush explained his reasons for escalating the war.
I'm frustrated at times about Iraq because I understand the consequences of failure. And I want the Iraqis to succeed for our own sake. This is a war, part of a broader war, and that if we fail in Iraq, there's a better likelihood that the enemy comes and hurts us here. And so I'm frustrated with the progress. If you were to put me in an opinion poll and said, do I approve of Iraq, I'd be one of those who said, no, I don't approve of what's taking place in Iraq. On the other hand,
President Bush says he'll proceed with the escalation no matter the result of an impending vote in Congress on whether to support the White House plan. Senate Democrats are expected to announce a resolution by Thursday, with the House soon to follow. As thousands of troops prepare to go to Iraq, more could also be on the way to Afghanistan. Military officials are seeking additional troops amid reports violence has reached its highest level since the U.S. invasion. The New York Times reports today cross-border attacks from Pakistan have tripled since the fall. Suicide bombings increased 400% last year, while roadside bombs more than doubled. On a visit to Kabul Tuesday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said a troop increase is possible.
I'm concerned in the short time I have been in this position to ensure that the success that we have had in Afghanistan together remain a success and not be challenged. I think it's important for us to take the initiative in dealing with security threats, that we act together on this. And if the commanders in the field believe that more forces are required to do that, then I certainly would be strongly inclined to recommend that to the president.
A top Interior Department official is under scrutiny after it was revealed she knew oil and gas companies had avoided billions of dollars in payments 2 years earlier than she recently claimed. The case centers around the disclosure a bureaucratic error allowed offshore drilling companies to avoid paying royalties for extracting oil and gas from public waters. In September, Minerals Management Service Director Johnny Burton said she was informed of the matter just last year, but Burton has now admitted she was told 3 years ago. An independent investigation says the government could have collected nearly $1 billion in just the last 3 years. A top Pentagon official has apologized after urging U.S. corporations to boycott law firms whose attorneys represent prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. In a radio interview last week, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs Charlie Cully Stimson said companies might wish to shun firms that represent, quote, the very terrorists who hit their bottom line back in 2001. In a letter, the Washington Post, Stimson said those comments don't reflect his core beliefs. The Pentagon also disavowed Stimson's remarks. The apology came after groups including the American Bar Association and deans of more than 130 law schools issued harsh condemnations. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Meanwhile, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has given a new reason why Guantanamo prisoners have not been brought to trial. In an interview with the Associated Press, Gonzalez said prisoners have not been tried because of numerous legal challenges from their lawyers. In response, the Center for Constitutional Rights President Michael Ratner said, quote, "We've been trying for 5 years to get the majority of the detainees in federal court. They've resisted from the first day they took people to Guantanamo," he said. In news from Washington, Senator Barack Obama has moved a step closer to the 2008 presidential race. In a video posted on his website Tuesday, the junior senator from Illinois said he's forming an exploratory committee towards a bid that could make him the nation's first black president.
For the next several weeks, I'm going to talk with people from around the country, listening and learning more about the challenges we face as a nation, the opportunities that lie before us, and the role that a presidential campaign might play in bringing our country together. And on February 10th, at the end of these discussions and in my home state of Illinois, I'll share my plans with my friends, neighbors, and fellow Americans.
New York Senator Hillary Clinton's expected to announce her candidacy in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani indicates he's preparing to seek the Republican presidential nomination.
Seeing how much money we can raise, how many people we can put together. We're studying the issues, spending a lot of time studying the issues that exist now and the ones that you think might exist a year and a half, 2 years from now, so that you can determine whether you can make a big difference. And we'll decide sometime this year, you know.
Giuliani was speaking to the Foreign Press Association in Rome. Giuliani's campaign suffered a possible setback this month when leaked campaign documents suggested he might drop out of the race due to insurmountable personal and political concerns. You can go to our website to get our conversation with Wayne Barrett on that story. In Spain, an arrest warrant has been reissued for three U.S. soldiers connected to the killing of Spanish TV cameraman José Coso in Iraq. Coso was one of two journalists killed in April of 2003 when the U.S. military opened fire on Baghdad's Palestine Hotel. The new warrant came after the Spanish Supreme Court overturned an earlier ruling dismissing charges against the soldiers. The U.S. government did not respond to the previous arrest warrants nor to requests to provide statements from the soldiers. In UN news, two people have been charged with bribery and conspiracy to commit wire fraud in connection with the UN's Oil for Food program in Iraq. On Tuesday, federal prosecutors unsealed indictments against former Oil for Food director Benin Sevan and Ephraim Nadler, the brother-in-law of former Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The Oil for Food program allowed the Iraqi government to use oil revenue to buy humanitarian goods while it was under international sanctions. UN spokesperson Farhan Haq says the UN will cooperate.
We have yet to actually see the formal indictment, and so I would wait until we have that to have any details on that. Obviously, what we have been urging is for all parties to cooperate with the authorities on this matter. And the Secretary General today did reiterate that we would continue to cooperate as we can.
Sevan is charged with receiving $160,000 from the Iraqi government. His lawyer says the charges are baseless. Other critics have argued the charges linked to UN officials are a fraction of the billions of dollars Saddam Hussein received through key U.S. allies, Turkey and Jordan, with the Bush administration's full cooperation. In Israel, the head of the Israeli Defense Forces has resigned after an internal review criticized his handling of Israel's attack on Lebanon last summer. Lieutenant General Dan Chalutz has also come under criticism after it was revealed he sold tens of thousands of dollars worth of stock within the first hours of the war. And finally, new developments in the military tribunal of First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. The judge in the case has ruled Watada's defense won't be able to present evidence challenging the legality of the war, nor explain Watada's motive to resist deploying to Iraq. Watada faces up to 6 years in prison. He's the first commissioned officer to refuse deployment orders to Iraq. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Besides wiretapping your phone and going through your mail, the Pentagon and CIA can also demand access to your bank transactions and credit reports at any time, all in the name of national security. The New York Times reported Sunday that both agencies were using powers granted to them by the Patriot Act to secretly examine the financial assets and transactions of perhaps thousands of American citizens without court approval. The Pentagon and CIA obtained the private banking records by issuing national security letters to request banks, credit card companies, and other financial institutions to voluntarily hand over information. The program's been taking place even though the military and the CIA are barred from conducting traditional domestic law enforcement work. Vice President Dick Cheney has defended the program. He was asked about it on Fox News Sunday by host Chris Wallace.
There's a report in the New York Times today that's been confirmed by administration officials that the Pentagon and the CIA have been obtaining financial records about hundreds of Americans suspected of involvement in either terrorism or espionage. Why involve the CIA and the Pentagon in domestic intelligence gathering?
Well, remember what these issues are. This is a question, as I understand it, of issuing national security letters that allow us to collect financial information, for example, on suspected or on people we have reason to suspect. The Defense Department gets involved because we've got hundreds of bases inside the United States that are potential terrorist targets. We've got hundreds of thousands of people, innocent Americans.
But why not let the FBI do that, sir?
Well, they can do a certain amount of it, and they do. But the Department of Defense has legitimate authority in this area. This is an authority that goes back three or four decades. It was reaffirmed in the Patriot Act that was renewed here about a year or so ago. It's a perfectly legitimate activity. There's nothing wrong with it or illegal. It doesn't violate people's civil rights. And if an institution that receives one of these national security letters disagrees with it, they're free to go to court to try to stop its execution. So there's, you know, this is a dramatic story, but I think it's important for people to understand here. This is a legitimate security effort that's been underway for a long time, and it does not represent a new departure from the standpoint of our efforts to protect ourselves against terrorist attacks.
Your former...
That was Vice President Dick Cheney being questioned by Fox's Chris Wallace. The American Civil Liberties Union says it has serious concerns about the program, and the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Sylvester Reyes, said his panel investigate how the Pentagon is using its authority. One of the most prominent targets of the program was James Yee, the former Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay. The military obtained Yee's private financial records after he was falsely accused of espionage. Yee spent 76 days in solitary confinement and was subject to abusive treatment. In 2004, the government dropped all the charges against him. Chaplain Yee joins us on the line now from Seattle. And on Washington, D.C., we're joined by Lisa Graves, Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Lisa Graves, I'd like to start with you. Can you explain the scope of this and talk about the different government agencies and what these security letters mean?
Sure. Good morning, Amy. I'm happy to discuss that. Right now, we have a situation which the Pentagon and CIA are exercising an increasing role domestically in terms of monitoring Americans. Traditionally, law enforcement and counterterrorism has been conducted by the FBI under strict guidelines, but this administration has unleashed those incredibly powerful agencies on Americans. And as Vice President Cheney said, basically the rationale is because there are bases in the U.S., anyone in the U.S. in essence can be the subject of these demands for their private financial records.
And how have things changed over time?
Well, the Patriot Act did change the powers for the FBI to obtain information about Americans without them being individually suspected of doing anything wrong. That's one of the powers that needs to be reformed. But we have a situation in which this administration has taken a very dim view of privacy, a very dim view of civil liberties, and in fact seems to believe that anything and everything is justified in the name of the war on terror, including spying on Americans, opening their mail, assembling massive databases. One of the most interesting and disturbing things about the story in the New York Times were the repeated statements of the administration officials that even if a person was cleared on the basis of examining their private financial records without their knowledge, that the government was going to keep that information in essence forever in case it might someday be useful and keep it in a new database, yet another database for data mining called Portico, which would give the Pentagon a doorway into monitoring and collecting and maintaining records on innocent Americans indefinitely. This is very disturbing and warrants serious congressional investigation.
What triggers an investigation?
Well, at this point, it's not entirely clear what the basis for any particular investigation is by the CIA or the Defense Department, except for that they would claim that there's some sort of relevance to the war on terrorism or counterintelligence or protecting the bases. And as we've seen through other revelations, the Pentagon has been using its powers to investigate people who simply disagree with the war in Iraq, to surveil them. We've seen that even the FBI has been using the Joint Terrorism Task Forces across the United States with local law enforcement to investigate local churches, including Catholic churches, mosques, and other places where people simply disagree with the war in Iraq. And so it's unclear that the administration is imposing any real limits to protect civil liberties. In fact, it seems that they aren't protecting on a consistent basis any real limits, and instead are encouraging massive, widespread compilation of data, and are exploring how to connect all these different databases and maintain data on Americans who've done nothing wrong.
Former Guantanamo Chaplain James Yee also joins us in studio in Seattle, Washington. Chaplain Yee, can you explain how this story relates to your own case?
All right, Amy. First, it's a pleasure to be with you today. But yeah, it was Sunday when I learned that that my records had actually been probed through these national security letters by the Pentagon. And for me, this is just another stinging stab wound in addition to the other things that I was subjected to, the 76 days in isolated solitary confinement, the outrageous accusations of spying and espionage that were levied against me, and the torturous sensory deprivation that I was subjected to. So this is just another thing that I find very disturbing that has happened to me in this whole harrowing experience.
And what is your understanding of exactly what took place in your case, how they got the information and what kind of information they got, James Yee?
From my understanding of what had happened is that when I was arrested, when I was under some type of suspicion as the Muslim chaplain working down in Guantanamo, the Pentagon used a national security letter to probe into my banking, my credit records, and my financial records without a court-approved warrant. And to me, this should raise concerns for every American, because this is an indication that our civil liberties are quickly eroding, and in this case, it's our precious right to privacy.
Lisa Graves, what about the issue of how long the government keeps the information? The New York Times says, even when the initial suspicions are unproven, the documents have intelligence value, military officials say. In the next year, they plan to incorporate the records into a database at the Counterintelligence Field Activity Office at the Pentagon to track possible threats against the military.
I think that that is one of the very disturbing aspects of these revelations. The administration has taken a view, in essence, that anything it collects, whether it's lawful or unlawfully collected on Americans, it can keep, in essence, forever. That's one of the reasons why allowing the defense agencies and CIA to be involved in surveilling Americans is particularly troubling and disturbing, because these agencies have the capacity, the financial capacity and the technological capacity, to interconnect and create and maintain files on Americans as never before. And as we saw in that story, the administration has in essence determined that everything is relevant in essence forever. And so these are going to be persistent violations of Americans' privacy unless Congress steps in. And the administration claims that basically anything you turn over to a third party is fair game, that you have no right to privacy in it. But I think Americans would beg to disagree. If they share their information with their bank, their phone company, they talk on a telephone, those are private matters that are not for government intrusion without a proper investigation based on them doing something wrong.
Lisa Graves, there's a piece in the Washington Post today by Walter Pincus called Protesters Found in Database that says a Defense Department database devoted to gathering information on potential threats to military facilities and personnel known as Talon had 13,000 entries as of a year ago, including more than 2,800 reports involving American citizens, according to an internal Pentagon memo released today by the American Civil Liberties Union. The Pentagon memo says an examination of the system led to the deletion of more than 1,100 reports involving Americans, 186 of which dealt with, quote, anti-military protests or demonstrations in the U.S.
Well, this is, again, a documented example of the problems with giving the Department of Defense or allowing the Department of Defense this sort of unchecked power. Congress has been learning of these situations by headlines, not by having any meaningful oversight or investigation, and not by imposing any serious checks on government power. And so I'm very hopeful that this Congress will finally take a serious look at this and stop this pattern. Just because the Pentagon deletes names at this time based on revelations in the news doesn't mean that it has cured the underlying problems. And in fact, we've seen that the administration is moving to consolidate these databases and have them communicate with one another and allow extensive data mining of the records of innocent people and to do so indefinitely. And this must be challenged and stopped.
James Yee, for those who don't remember what happened to you, I mean, you describe it in your book, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. Just so that we understand what it means when the government gets involved in, gets information, talk about how this story fits into your own case. Briefly describe what happened to you, how you were picked up.
Right. Well, I was the Muslim chaplain who was assigned to the Joint Task Force down in Guantanamo for most of 2003, and during that time, I was objecting enormously to the abuses that was being carried out in the prisoners down there. And when I came back into the United States, I was arrested in Florida, jailed for 76 days, put in isolation, treated harshly, subjected to sensory deprivation, held initially incommunicado, and eventually released, cleared. I received my honorable discharge in 2005 in addition to a second U.S. Army Commendation Medal. And now I'm finding out that my records during that time were probed, my financial records, my banking records. And again, this is highly, highly disturbing and, in my view, very inappropriate with regard to getting into my private life, especially after I've been cleared as being a patriotic American citizen, a third-generation Chinese-American, and a veteran of the U.S. Army who has served in two of our nation's conflicts.
When do you understand they got this information, and do they still have it, and when will you be suing?
I'm assuming they still have the information, and I'm guessing that they did all this while I was under investigation. But I'm concerned on whether or not they are continuing to get into my records. I'm now even more concerned as to whether or not the government is opening my mail, whether they are going into my home when my family and I are perhaps shopping at the mall. So this raises a lot of fears in me with regard to am I being watched for the rest of my life? With regard to any legal action, I have contacted some organizations, the ACLU, and I know the Center for Constitutional Rights is looking into the legal issues here. And if there's significant grounds for a lawsuit and that helps the nation get back on track with regard to protecting our civil liberties, then I think that has to be considered.
Finally, James Yee, in our next segment, we're going to look at the story of the top Pentagon official who urged U.S. corporations to boycott law firms whose attorneys represented prisoners at Guantanamo. You were a chaplain at Guantanamo. How important was it for these prisoners to be represented by lawyers?
First of all, I can speak from firsthand experience the importance of having legal representation. I myself, of course, was subjected to the military justice system being falsely accused. And without the help of the legal expert, Mr. Eugene Fidel, who represented me, perhaps I wouldn't be sitting here with you today in this interview and would maybe still be behind bars on death row somewhere. So the importance of due process, the importance of being properly represented as a defendant is a founding principle of law and something that our nation has to abide by.
You were originally threatened with the death penalty, is that right?
Right. I was threatened with a death penalty during the time I was being accused of these heinous crimes of spying, espionage, and aiding the enemy.
James Yee, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Muslim chaplain posted at Guantanamo Bay in 2002, spent 76 days in solitary confinement. He's written a book about his experience called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. Lisa Graves, deputy director of the Center for National Security Studies, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we turn now to jury selection for the trial of Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, which has begun this week, Louis Scooter Libby faces five counts of lying to federal investigators, perjury, and obstruction of justice. He's accused of lying to investigators in a grand jury during the investigation of the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Plame is the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who openly accused the Bush administration of manipulating and distorting pre-war intelligence in Iraq. He's also accused of attempting to conceal his role and possibly that of others in leaking to the media that Wilson's wife was a CIA officer. Libby's defense team is expected to call his former boss, Vice President Dick Cheney, to testify as a witness. On Sunday, Chris Wallace of Fox News questioned Vice President Dick Cheney about the case.
Your former chief of staff, Scooter Libby, goes on trial this coming week on charges of obstruction of justice and perjury. As I mentioned to Mrs. Cheney when she was here a few weeks ago, I happened to notice that you invited Mr. Libby to your Christmas party, which you also invited me to. Given his legal troubles, why?
Why what?
Why invite him to your party?
He's a friend. He's a good man. He is one of the finest individuals I've ever known. I did invite him to the Christmas party. The last 2 years, he's been at our Christmas party, and before that, when
he was
working for me. I believe he's one of the more honest men I know. He's a good man.
That was Vice President Dick Cheney on Fox this past Sunday. Well, Murray Wass joins us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. He's a veteran investigative journalist who writes for the National Journal. He's broken a number of stories on the saga of the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Welcome to Democracy Now! Once again, Murray.
Thank you.
Murray, you've written a piece, CIA Leak Probe Inside the Grand Jury. Well, what leak have you gotten now?
Well, the key thing in the story that we just did is in the grand jury transcripts, what it shows is that the special prosecutor and his deputies, Patrick Fitzgerald and the line prosecutors who work for him, were very skeptical of Scooter Libby's claims that he outed Valerie Plame and provided the information to reporters, and that he did this on his own. And so even though a lot of people have suspected this, and especially people who have listened to your program and have followed this a great deal, this is the prosecutor himself saying this.
Explain exactly what information you got.
Well, what's really interesting is that on each occasion that, on literally each occasion that Scooter Libby goes out and talks to a reporter, Judith Miller of The Times, Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, and gives them information about Valerie Plame or gives them her name and tries to you know, retaliate against her husband or try and get this information out. Literally before that, Scooter Libby meets with Dick Cheney, and according to the story that Cheney and Libby both tell to investigators, is that they meet, they discuss ways to discredit and rebut Wilson, and Cheney directs Libby to release some type of classified information to the press. But lo and behold, when Libby then goes out and talks to that press person at the direction of the vice president, he usually also gives them the name of Valerie Plame and the information about Plame. And in some instances, when Libby and Cheney meet, and Cheney directs Libby to go talk to the press and leak something, he doesn't leak that, but he leaks Plame's name. So that raises the obvious, you know, inference and good possibility that Cheney, in fact, you know, is possibly directing Libby to do this, and that the reason that Libby is standing trial and the reason that he committed perjury is basically to cover for the vice president. And that's not my opinion, but that apparently is the opinion of the investigators who have worked on this for 3 years.
Can you give us the chronology as you lay it out in your piece, beginning with late in the morning of July 12, 2003, Vice President Dick Cheney standing atop a pier at the Naval Station Norfolk in Virginia, awaiting the commissioning of the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan?
On the morning of July 12th, Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby, they go to Norfolk, the naval station in Norfolk. It's an extraordinary thing. It's the commissioning of the nuclear power aircraft carrier, Nimitz-class USS Reagan. The carrier's 20 stories high. It took 8 years to build. 15,000 to 20,000 people are standing under the clear sky. Nancy Reagan christens the ship. And it's this extraordinary, you know, moment for both Cheney and Libby. The war in Iraq is 4 months kind of over. They don't know quite. People haven't come to terms that there's an insurgency yet. No one knows it's going wrong. And yet, on the plane ride home from this, Cheney and Libby are obsessed about the fact that Ambassador Joe Wilson has days earlier, indeed exactly 4 days earlier, in fact, written a column saying that Libby and Cheney distorted intelligence to make the case to go to war with Iraq. And so they're sitting on the plane, Cheney, Libby, and another woman named Catherine Martin, and they're sitting there strategizing, how are we gonna undercut Wilson? How are we gonna, how are we gonna make him look bad? You know, what can we do? And So on the plane, Cheney actually directs Libby to go talk to reporters and to leak a then highly classified document, the debriefing of Wilson's trip back from Niger to reporters. And because they think this is going to hurt Wilson's credibility. So literally, you know, within a short time after Scooter Libby gets off the plane and the vice president directs him, he calls Judith Miller of the New York Times, he calls Matt Cooper, but he says literally nothing about the classified information that the vice president wants him to. You know, instead he talks about Valerie Plame. So that raises the question as to whether the other thing was just a cover story, and what Cheney really wanted in the leak was Plame's name.
Murray Wass, why is Scooter Libby, according to your version of events, doing this? He's been accused of covering up, of lying. Who is he lying for?
Well, he could be lying to save his own neck. He does have a presumption of innocence here, you know, like anybody who's being tried. Although in this case, the witnesses are so strong against this guy. You know, in other words, there's three journalists who are going to testify against him. There's six government officials.
The three journalists are?
Matt Cooper, Judith Miller, and Tim Russert all basically are pretty much going to get up and contradict what he said.
Explain what Tim Russert has said. What has he told the grand jury? What has he spoken to the grand jury?
Tim Russert's role is this, and it's a little hard for people who don't follow it that carefully. But what had happened is when Cheney and Libby talk regularly, like according to the grand jury information that we just published, the vice president was apoplectic, he was angry, he raised the issue of Valerie Plame again and again with Libby. He wrote in the margins of an op-ed, you know, I don't understand why we send ambassadors pro bono. And Libby himself testified that they talked about this several times a day, every day, for at least a week or 2 weeks after this column came out. So what happens is that when he then talks to the press, when he then actually goes out, essentially Libby then gets caught at some point talking to the press, leaking Plame's name and leaking information to Plame and outing Plame to these various journalists. And then he has to come up with an explanation. So he's learned this information from Vice President Cheney. Indeed, the investigators have notes of Libby's, in which Libby says in the notes, "I learned this from the vice president." And there's also six government officials, a CIA briefing officer, Assistant Secretary of State, who say quite emphatically that based on inquiries from Libby, they told him that Plame was a CIA operative or whatever. So to get out of trouble, what Libby did was when he got caught telling journalists, he then made up a whole phony story, according to the prosecutors. And what he told them was this, that he talked to Tim Russert, the NBC bureau chief, and Tim Russert was the guy who told him that Plame was a covert CIA operative, and that Russert told him that NBC had been hearing these rumors from other journalists. So Libby's explanation was, you know, all I was doing was passing along unfounded rumors that I represented as rumors that I'd heard from other journalists. But Russert is testifying that that's a complete lie, that when he talked to Libby, they didn't even talk about Plame. And so the prosecutors are charging that as one of the counts of perjury and lying to investigators, so he could devise a cover story as to why he actually, you know, as to how he learned Plame's name and leaked it.
And what do you make of, Chris Wallace is invited to the Cheney's Christmas party. He first, after the party, has Lynn Cheney on, the vice president's wife, and asks about Scooter Libby, and she talks about him being a patriot, I'm paraphrasing, and then he has Dick Cheney on, and he also says, interesting choice of words, "I believe he's one of the more honest people that I know."
Well, Fox News, fair and objective. You know, I mean, what more can one say? I mean, the vice president, what is being done here is what we've seen being done is we've seen ever since Watergate, presidents have learned that if they want to be above the law, if they want their aides to get away with doing things, and we saw this in Iran-Contra, what you do is you essentially hold out the pardon power for them. So Cheney is keeping Libby, you know, who's close to vest because Libby is somebody who could testify against the vice president. So the vice president is keeping that relationship. If you remember, one of the interesting things about this, if people remember during Watergate, one of the impeachment charges was that Nixon raised millions of dollars in hush money for the Watergate burglars to shut them up. Well, today we have a mechanism where we don't have to do that. But in the case of Libby, he's raised $3 million. A friend of the president, a major fundraiser for President Bush, for Dick Cheney, for the Republican Party, a strip mall developer in Florida named Mel Sumler has raised millions of dollars. So if you're a guy like Scooter Libby...
For Scooter Libby's defense?
Yeah, for Scooter Libby's defense. The press reports are right. It's $3 million. The guy who's in charge of that fund, who's raised a good part of it, is a former ambassador, key Republican Party fundraiser. So instead, you know, if the President Nixon goes out, for example, and raises money... you know, under the table, that's illegal. But what's done nowadays is that people like Scooter Libby are taken care of. He's like a high-paying job where he makes more money than Amy Goodman or Murray Wass or probably 90% of listeners for not even showing up. And then he has $3 million for his defense fund. So essentially, a president or a vice president like Cheney can say, stick with us. We'll get you the best lawyers. You could be acquitted at trial. If you're not acquitted at trial, you have another bite at the apple because then we'll have you pardoned. And so they really take care of these guys. And such we saw this in Iran-Contra, the same type of thing where the first President Bush just pardoned most of the key defendants on Christmas Eve before he left office.
Murray Wass, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you very much for being with us. Veteran investigative journalist writing for the National Journal, maintains a blog at whateveralready.blogspot.com. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. John Fahey, Desperate Man, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A top Pentagon official has urged U.S. corporations to boycott law firms whose attorneys represent detainees at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo. Charles Cully Stimson, who is Assistant Secretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs, spoke last Thursday to Federal Radio News on the fifth anniversary of the first prisoners being sent to Guantanamo. Stimson listed some of the most prestigious corporate law firms in the country that are providing free representation to prisoners and said companies might want to consider taking their business elsewhere to firms that are not, quote, representing terrorists.
The result of a FOIA request through a major news organization, somebody asked, who are the lawyers around this country representing detainees down there? And you know what? It's shocking. The major law firms in this country, Pillsbury, Winthrop, Jenner and Block, Wilmer Cutler, Pickering, Covington and Burling here in D.C., Sutherland, Asbill, Brennan, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Mayor Brown, Weil Gotshal, Pepper Hamilton, Venable, Alston and Byrd, Perkins Coie, Hunton and Williams, Fulbright, Jaworski, all the rest of them are out there representing detainees. And I think, quite honestly, when corporate CEOs see that those firms are representing the very terrorists who hit their bottom line back in 2001, those CEOs are going to make those law firms choose between representing terrorists or representing reputable firms. And I think that is going to have major play in the next few weeks.
But clearly,
it'll be fun to watch that play out.
But clearly, Secretary, the attorneys who are representing the terrorist detainees, they are being paid by someone. I mean, there must be an organization that is funding this representation. Who is that?
It's not clear, is it? Some will maintain that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart, that they're doing it pro bono, and I suspect they are. Others are receiving monies from who knows where, and I'd be curious to have them explain that.
That was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs Charles Cully Stimson speaking last week on Federal News Radio. The American Bar Association immediately condemned his remarks, calling them deeply offensive to the legal profession, and 130 U.S. law school deans signed a letter also condemning his remarks. The Pentagon's distanced itself from Stimson, saying he was not speaking for the Bush administration. Now, Stimson has apologized for his remarks. In a letter to the Washington Post today, he writes, quote, those comments don't reflect my core belief. He adds, quote, I believe firmly that a foundational principle of our legal system is that the system works best when both sides are represented by competent legal counsel. Well, Stephen Oleski and Emily Spieler join me now from Boston. Stephen is a partner in the litigation and real estate departments at the law firm WilmerHale. He represents six Guantanamo prisoners. Emily Spieler is dean of Northeastern University's School of Law. She's the co-author of the dean's letter condemning Stimson's remarks. We invited a representative from the Pentagon to join us, but they declined our request. I want to go first to Emily Spieler. You co-wrote with Harold Coe, of the dean of Yale Law School, this letter. Can you talk about your core objections to what this top Pentagon official had to say?
Well, it is in fact true, as he said apparently in his letter today, that what he said goes against the very basic tenets of not only American but also international law in the role of that lawyers should play, particularly in those cases in which there may be unpopular defendants who need competent legal counsel. The drafting of the letter was actually not difficult. Dean Coe and I agreed quite quickly on what the letter should say. And what was astonishing was the rapidity of the response from deans across the country. This clearly struck a chord for all of us, I think, in terms of what is critical that we teach our students and stand for within the legal profession. If we can't encourage people to do these kinds of cases, in fact, the American legal system is in jeopardy. If we can't tell our students that they should do this, it's in jeopardy. If people in law firms feel that they're taking risks by doing it, risks that will affect their bottom line, they won't do it. And again, it goes to the core of our basic legal structure.
What about the issue that this top Pentagon official is raising? Who knows where these attorneys are getting their funding?
When we talk about pro bono work, we are in fact talking about firms making decisions internally to take on cases and provide representation for free. That is what pro bono work is. And most parts of the organized bar are extremely interested in seeing larger firms with greater resources step up to do more pro bono work, not less, both on unpopular, potentially unpopular cases, as well as in representation of people who simply can't afford representation within our own domestic courts. So To me, the notion that the administration or anyone who's in power would make decisions about what's acceptable pro bono work and what isn't is deeply troubling.
Stephen Oleski, you're a partner in the litigation and real estate department at WilmerHale. You represent six Guantanamo detainees. You are one of the law firms that this Pentagon official raised, that Stimson raised, in raising the possibility of boycott, though he has apologized now. What do you make of the apology, and talk about the case that you represent?
I think the apology is deserved. Obviously, the remark shouldn't have been made. We have had, as habeas counsel, and there are about, I think, 500 of us now to fight since 2002 to get the right to hearings from men in Guantanamo. They are, almost all of them there have never been charged with anything. They have never had any hearings. They have never had any trials. And the government has fought every step of the way to prevent those trials and hearings from taking place. So his remarks, his unfortunate remarks, really reflect at an operational level what we've been confronting as habeas counsel, which is the inability to have a basic principle of Anglo-American jurisprudence going back to the English common law vindicated in this case, which is that the king, or in this case the executive, can't hold people indefinitely without charges or trial. That's what habeas corpus is all about. That's why it's in the United States Constitution in Article I. That's why it's so important. That's why the Supreme Court has twice said in various ways these men deserve to have hearings about their confinement, and yet these hearings have still not taken place. Our appeals are still in the federal system, and it appears at this moment that it's a fair distance from today to such hearings. That's very disturbing to anyone who believes in the American justice system, as most lawyers do. I hope all lawyers do, in fact.
What do you make of what Attorney General Berto Gonzalez said, blaming the delays in trying these prisoners at Guantanamo on you, on the lawyers, not you specifically, but saying the trials may start by this summer? Gonzalez told the Associated Press this. He said rules for the military commissioner being sent up to Capitol Hill this week. He said it's not for lack of trying. When asked about the legal fate of the prisoners who've been held at the military facility in some cases for 5 years, he said we're challenged every step of the way.
The Attorney General appears to be addressing the approximately 12 people who have been formally charged under what's called the military commission system. Those people, ironically, in a sense, do have the right to a trial. As a result of the Hamdan decision last summer, the Supreme Court has required the government to write new rules, which the Attorney General is referring to, for those trials. They'll have cross-examination, they'll have witnesses, they'll have an appeal within the military system. What that statement by the Attorney General omits is that almost everyone else at Guantanamo has not been charged under that system. And therefore, they're people who, as Justice O'Connor said in 2004, are being potentially sentenced to indefinite life imprisonment without any hearing. The habeas counsel haven't done anything to delay those hearings, which, as I noted earlier, haven't been held and are still some distance from being held. We are the lawyers in the system advocating that there be trials so that guilt or innocence on some charge can be heard and decided.
Very quickly, Stephen Oleski, can you talk about the six Guantanamo prisoners that you represent?
Yes, my clients were living and working in Bosnia, essentially as social workers, after September 11th. They were married, they had children, they were very much in the fabric of Bosnian society. They were arrested at the insistence of the United States, who said they were terrorists. The Bosnian legal system, which we established in the Dayton Accords in 1995, investigated them and reviewed them for 90 days. That system determined that there was not any evidence to hold them. They were ordered released by a court in Bosnia. An injunction was entered by a human rights court in Bosnia preventing their being taken out of Bosnia. The United States demanded, nonetheless, that they be taken to Guantanamo, and the Bosnian government acceded to that demand. They've been there since January 20th, 2005, which will be 6 years starting in a couple of days. It's been a very long 5 years for those six men.
They haven't been charged.
They have not been charged with anything, and as I say, they should either be returned home, as many others have already been done by multilateral negotiations, by bilateral negotiations with the Bosnian government in this case, or they ought to have habeas corpus proceedings, as our legal system has provided for hundreds of years.
The response of the government, not specifically in the case of your the detainees you represent, but saying sometimes they want to send them home, but they don't want them to be persecuted at home.
That's not an issue in Bosnia. It's a multiracial society. The government, it was very carefully structured in the Dayton Accords to contain representatives of the Serbian, Croatian, and Bosniak communities. And my clients would not be in any jeopardy if they were returned back to Bosnia from which they were taken. The Bosnian government last year conceded in a letter to the Secretary General of the Council of Europe that what happened was an illegal handover. What we would like is a judge to look at that frank admission by the Bosnian government, to look at American law in light of that admission, and to determine whether there's any further basis to hold these men. We believe there is not.
Dean Spieler, while this top Pentagon official did make these comments, he did take them back. Mr. Stimson did take them back. Do you think that there was a message being sent out?
Well, there certainly seemed to be. I think that the retraction was appropriate and needed, but the sense that there might be a chilling effect on the willingness of lawyers to take unpopular or difficult cases because they might be under attack by the administration and they might find that their firms have some of their business jeopardized is deeply troubling. And I think that the retraction is important, but the alacrity with which the organized bar, the American Bar Association, and also law deans responded is partly a reflection of the need for this continued response. I think fear, perhaps hope, that the retraction was a result of the response, but on the other hand, the statements should never have been made. And it's important that those of us who are leaders within the legal community continue to be vigilant on this issue.
And very quickly, the last point that Stimson made, the questioning of possibly where some of the money might come from to support the so-called pro bono work. Do you think there's suggestions of investigations of law firms?
That certainly sounded like what was being suggested, or that there should be a cloud over these law firms as a result of this suggestion. And I think that that's abhorrent.
Do you think, Dean Spieler, that the Guantanamo prison should be shut down?
You know, I don't know as much as Mr. Oleski does about the substance of this debate, and I would prefer to defer to him on that question.
Well,
I think it's critical that America, the United States, adhere to international norms.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there.
Community.
Dean Spieler, thanks for joining us. Stephen Oleski as well. That does it for our show. DemocracyNow.org is our website for transcript, audio, and video. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire from Doko Deuce, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anna Nagara. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.